Good day, everyone. My name is March Twisdale, and you're listening to my 2019 Encore series of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. This show is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon and airs at 11 a.m. every Saturday and 12 noon every Monday on your favorite station, 101.9 FM, KVSH. Thank you for making Voice of Vashon and Prose, Poetry, and Purpose a part of your day. On a more personal note, you may know that in December of 2018, I lost my dad, and my 2019 Encore series is dedicated to his success as a parent. For 46 years, my dad inspired me, and each Encore presentation will include a short story about how he impacted my life with some of my dad's favorite music at the end of the show. So today, I want to talk to you about cookies. And I'm going to talk about Christmas, even though we're nowhere near December and a lot of you may not celebrate that holiday. That's fine. I understand. But when I grew up, we celebrated Christmas. And what was interesting is that we didn't celebrate it because my dad was super into the holiday. We celebrated it because sort of society was, and he didn't want to sort of deprive me or my brothers of being able to do that. But it was definitely not his favorite thing to do. My dad didn't have good memories really from his childhood, so Christmas in a way was sort of ruined for him. So I want to share one of the things that we did that I carried forward for my whole life that was super amazing, and that has to do with cookies. We would make gingerbread cookies every year, and we made them for the whole month of December. Now, remember, my dad was not super into socializing. We weren't going to any parties. This was all for in the family, right? And my dad was really good at coming up with fun things to do at home that didn't cost anything or hardly nothing. So all December, we would make gingerbread cookies, and then we would decorate them with this special frosting that was just sort of simply made out of egg whites and powdered sugar with coloring. And you would put it in a little plastic bag, like a sandwich bag with not a pleated bottom. These are the old-fashioned simple bags, right? You don't want a pleated bottom. And then you would just tie it up in a little knot, get the air out of it, and make a little snip at the point, and out comes this really nice frosting that dries quickly and will hold its shape. So if you make little dots on your cookie, the dot will stay as a ball. It's not going to spread out and go flat on you. So what was cool about this was we spent our Christmases hanging out in the kitchen decorating cookies. That was like the main fun thing of the holiday. And when I was younger, and there was actually a tree, which a lot of years there wouldn't be a tree, but when I was young, I think my mom got a tree when I was like five for sure. And the cookies, once they'd been made and decorated, were then a little hole was made in them and they were tied under the tree so that every day after dinner, I could go stand there and stare at the tree until I eventually decided which cookie I wanted to have for dessert. And the cool thing about making these cookies was that it would take anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes to decorate one cookie. You would sort of get a plate, and we would all just sit down. It was quiet, relaxing, after-dinner activity. And you're just sitting there admiring each other's cookies and decorating cookies. And you might decorate four or five with the color white, and then you'd put the white back in the middle of the table because someone else is waiting for it, and you'd grab the green. And by now, the white frosting has sort of like dried enough that you can put little dots on top of it, and you would like decorate with the green, and then maybe put the green back and grab the red. And so we would end up spending countless hours feeling thoroughly enmeshed in the holiday, creating art with just the ingredients that is required to make a basic gingerbread recipe. And it also, when I was later in college, I would spend the whole month, the day after Thanksgiving, I made my first batch of gingerbread, and I would spend the whole month making these cookies that for me took 20 minutes a cookie to decorate because I did so much detail work, and they would freeze really well. So by the end of the month, I was handing out baggies with like, you know, six or seven of these precious cookies. Each one took 20 minutes of my time. We're talking like 2 hours worth of time or more in a little bag of cookies. And I would hand these out to, you know, fellow students or a teacher or a family member or whatever. And so they were also gifts. They were actually really, really impressive and valuable because the amount of time and love and interest and creativity that was put into them. So whereas some people might have their Christmas list and be out shopping at a store, I'm sitting at home every day, spending an hour or two decorating cookies, knowing that my Christmas list is going to be taken care of and that I'm going to be handing this personalized, you know, artwork that can be eaten. And people would be like, it's too pretty to eat. I'm like, yeah, I know, you'll think that for a while and eventually you'll eat one and they're delicious and then you won't be able to stop yourself. But I just want to throw that out there because I think a lot of times the consumer economic culture we live in that really drives us to be that hamster on the wheel running around doing things that consume massive amounts of resources, lots of money, and can ruin our holiday season. I just want to remind us all that we don't have to do that. You can actually do whatever you want. That's the point of being able to live in a free society that allows you to pursue happiness as you see fit. And so just whatever holiday it is, Thanksgiving, Christmas, 4th of July, you get to decide what you want to do with that holiday. And there are some simple and incredibly inexpensive ways to have a ton of joy and happiness with your friends and family. So that's something my dad taught me. And now on to the interview that I dug up from the archives that I think you're all going to enjoy a whole bunch today. Have a great day, and I'll see you next week. So, Garth, thank you for coming to the studio.
Oh, it's my pleasure to make a little trip over to Vashon.
Happy you're here, because the phone interviews are great, but I love having someone right in the room. I can actually look at them. So, book number one, Raven Stole the Moon. And if I pronounce it sort of vaguely correctly, Tlingit Indian in Alaska.
Southeastern Alaska, yes.
Southeastern Alaska. Okay, and your mom is Tlingit.
Yeah, my mother's side of the family was Tlingit. My mother grew up in the small town of Wrangell, Alaska. Which is almost as depressing as it sounds.
Oh.
We go there, we have kind of these weird family reunions. And so when someone dies, the tradition is the following 4th of July, we convene on Wrangell. And so we were just there a couple years ago for my uncle, and I had a cousin who just recently died. So it looks like I know where I'm going for the 4th of July.
That's a very interesting tradition. And the 4th makes sense, I guess, because the weather is really good.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have time off from work anyways.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a big deal. 4th of July is big in Alaska. The weather is nice. The light until 11:30 at night.
Yeah.
In the town of Wrangell, it's got maybe, 1,500 people max. And they have a whole parade. But the kids kind of get a lot of freedom to go running around and exploring and doing things that maybe we've somewhat lost. I think you retain it here on Vashon more than in the city over there. But
it is actually quite normal for your children to just wander off in the middle of the night into the forest. Actually, my son does it all the time.
Yeah.
And if I lived in, I don't know, Redmond, I'm not quite sure that would be the norm.
Child Protective Services would come and take your children away for being free range children.
Oh, yeah. I got to love that movement.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's true. It's true. Here, we've got a little bit more of the normalcy that existed 40 or 50 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, you know, things really have changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about it with regard to A Sudden Light. The book is actually set in 1990 because I wanted that pre-digital innocent age. And it's in a neighborhood that I grew up near in North Seattle. So we used to do things. I mean, both my parents worked. And the rule in the summer was, you know, be home by dinner, try not to get yourself abducted, you know, not to use too populist of a phrase, but we're not really living in the now. And in a sense, that's where we have to sort of try to refocus, I think, a little bit.
Right. Well, or we're living in a world of manufactured fear.
Definitely,
it is manufactured. I mean, there can be authentic reasons, but there are people who are intentionally using fear as a tool to manipulate. And that's what we have to become aware of. And then you can see it.
Right. Now, if we want to go far down that rabbit hole, the question is it just the narrative of fear that's being controlled by other people? Or is there actual fear being created? In other words, This is my new book I'm working on. I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it. But the idea of
spoilers or details.
No. But imagine if every single conspiracy theory in the world were true, you know, mm-hmm. and they all are, by the way. Then that's the world of my new book. So the corporations, the media, the government actually manufacturing mm-hmm. incidents of certain things, and then in order to create fear, and then denying that they happened.
It does sound like 1984.
Well, there's a little bit of that mixed in there. See, because what I find fascinating is that, you know, back in the old days of 1984, mm-hmm. when George Orwell wrote that, what was the idea of a totalitarian government? One that had one message and forced mm-hmm. that message down everybody's throat. Big Brother was there and you had to toe the Big Brother line.
Right.
Now, what's interesting is that the future as it has evolved is not that at all. We live in the same sort of fear-based society that they lived in, mm-hmm. but it's through disinformation and misinformation. Is there's too much information. The mm-hmm. idea of astroturfing, where people are fake grassroots groups do social media in order to obfuscate things that are discredit things that are really going on.
Oh yeah,
it's a flooding. So what's happening is they're flooding us with way too much innuendo, rumors, half truths, so that we can't figure out what the truth is. Mm-hmm. And in our confusion, then we just go to the simplest one.
Right.
And so So I'm writing a book about truth.
Well, and it's I'm sure it's got to be a lot of fun, actually, to be writing that book. I mean, this planet is just oozing with interesting stuff, whether it's what's going on psychologically in North Korea. I mean, okay, long story short, sociology was my love in college. So back to Raven Stole the Moon.
We're having a hard time talking about books here.
Exactly. Okay. So, I'm so excited about all four of these books. Raven Stole the Moon. What I found fascinating was not just a little bit of the storyline you were mentioning, but what I loved about it was that you have an authentic family life linkage to the story in a way. A little teaser for our listeners.
Sure. Raven Stole the Moon was my first novel. When I started writing it, I didn't realize I was writing a novel. I just was kind of rambling, and I wrote a bunch of pages, about 40 pages, and I gave them to my wife to read. She admitted that she was surprised. She said, keep writing. And so I did. And it's the story of a young mother, a woman who's comes from the same background that I had. She's not from Alaska, but her mother is. And she has a Tlingit Indian history. So as I do, I'm part Tlingit. And so all that's kind of mm-hmm. autobiographical in a way. And then it veers from that autobiography. She's on a vacation in Alaska near this town where her mother grew up, and her young child drowns in a boating accident. Mm. And it's very tragic, and they don't ever recover the body. A couple years pass, and her marriage completely falls apart, and she's mm-hmm. having addiction problems, and it's really, she doesn't know what to do. So she takes off, heads up to Alaska on the Alaska State Ferry, and she starts just trying to get in touch with herself, to just be alone, and things start to happen. Weird things start to, creepy things start to happen. And mm-hmm. she meets a shaman, but is he really? And she meets this strange guy who she kind of gets a crush on. And then this dog starts following her. And she gets embroiled in a whole, there's a myth of the Kushtaka among the Tlingit Indian. Mm-hmm. And the Kushtaka were given power by the raven to shapeshift. And they were given the duty to look after souls who might die of exposure or they were drowning, mm-hmm. and they were allowed to take those souls. And the Tlingit very much believe in reincarnation. So if you mm-hmm. don't have the body to release,
so you don't have the body to release.
You have to cremate the body to release the spirit.
And so if they die of exposure, meaning you never find them.
Right.
If you never drown, you never find them. Exactly. Okay. Oh, that's brilliantly interesting. Okay.
So the Kushtaka, and she starts hearing all about this and she starts learning about it. She's like, her son is with the Kushtaka.
Right.
So then it goes into really magical realism, and she has a whole journey into the netherworld, and it's about, you know, coming to terms with death and so forth.
And before that, I just want to give people some background. You were a documentary filmmaker. So that's just interesting background, I think, because documentary filmmakers are just doing really brilliant work so often, I think, at teasing out the important stories that need to be told.
Yeah, you still have to have the dramatic structure and everything, and it's sort of storytelling with found objects, I like to call it, and you have to try to craft the story that is compelling. And you are somewhat, you know, limited by your resources. And so in that sense, it's almost a puzzle like. But, you know, when I graduated from college and went to film school, I thought I would be a screenwriter. And I had a negative reaction to the whole medium. I just couldn't do it. Mm. That's when I veered into documentary films. And I wasn't really ready at that young age. I wasn't mature enough as a person or as a storyteller to be able to tell my own stories yet. So I really took refuge in the world of nonfiction film. Mm-hmm. It's really how flexible do you feel? I mean, when I write a book, for instance, I make an outline. I make an outline because it gives me something to adhere to. It gives me a structure that I can depend on if I need it. However, if there's any a detour comes up or a random occurrence happens, like a new character walks into the book or somebody does something I didn't expect, I go with that. I always go with the detour. If it doesn't work out, I can get back to my outline.
Right.
And I think if you take that idea and turn it into a metaphor and apply it to your life, then, you know, we all have our plan. We can have plans. But if something comes up, you got to take the detour. You know, the fun stuff happens on detours. You know, I worked for a Broadway producer for a while when I was in school. I worked for the Theater Guild, and they had a theater program, Theater at Sea. And so it was an insert program. So I worked on that for a number of years. I've seen on cruise ships with Helen Hayes and Mary Martin and Colleen Dewhurst and just crazy, you know, older Broadway stars. Mm-hmm. And I've seen every place in the world for 4 hours because I was on a cruise ship.
Oh,
and I was 23, 24, 25 years old. And it was great. I was getting paid.
I was going around
the world. And now my 8-year-old takes the globe and like points to, says, "You ever been to Hong Kong?" I'm like, "Yeah, I was Hong Kong before it was the new Hong Kong, when it was the old Hong Kong."
Right. Still under British.
Yeah.
Right. So I just think young people need to be reminded that there's this fabulous world out there waiting to be discovered, and don't limit your expectations of what can be out there.
Yeah, and I think that the world really has undergone huge change, and part of it is, of course, you know, just communications and the internet and the ability to sort of see and be exposed to new things. But for sure, I think you need to be able to, in the same way that, you know, there's no one way to get an education. You know, we were just talking about that a little bit earlier, and different modes of schooling and so forth. And if you're comfortable in a college environment and you want that, then go do that. But if you're not, there are a dozen other ways to get the exact same information faster and for less money than going to a grad school to get an MFA in writing or something like that. You know, these sorts of things.
Yeah.
That's what, when my wife and I have raised our kids, we always said, you know, it's okay. If you want to create an alternative version of how you see your life playing out, feel free to do it, but do it in a thoughtful and considered manner. That's all we ask. Just don't do it like willy-nilly, you know. Understand the ramifications of the decisions you're going to make, because they will affect you, but they're only going to affect you. They're not going to affect me.
Because it's your life to lead, you know.
Right. Which is a perfect segue into my second novel, How Evan Brooke is Head and Other Secrets.
Right. Okay, let's repeat the title for the listeners. So How Evan Broke His Head and Other Secrets is the title of your second published book.
That's right. And Evan is a 31-year-old slacker musician in Seattle. are there any of those?
No, of course. Very fictional. Yeah.
Evan has epilepsy, a very severe form of epilepsy that he got. Unfortunately, his father uses phrases like he gave to himself. He made a pretty stupid choice when he was young and got hit by a car, and due to the head trauma, he got this epilepsy. And the story of the book is, when the book opens, he's suddenly reunited with a 14-year-old son he didn't know he had. So he got a girl pregnant in high school. Their family moved away, and now suddenly he's grappling with having to take custody of this kid. Mm. And so it's a father and son sort of story, but talking about what we were just talking about children growing up, you know, Evan at 31 years old is, as he says, he lives down to expectations. Mm. His father is a famous surgeon at Harborview Medical Center and had plans for his son. His son went and screwed it up. And they say, "You messed up your life. You put yourself in this position. You're never going to amount to anything. Look at your brother. Look at him. He's a big famous lawyer now. And what are you?" And so rather than fight that narrative, Evan just accepts it. He says, "Right, you're right. Look at me. I'm bad." But then through contact with his 14-year-old kid, who's no angel, by the way, he understands that he is allowed to take control of his narrative. You know, we have our own story, right? And oftentimes our story is influenced by the people around us, especially our family members, telling us things about ourselves.
Right.
My mother-in-law used to do that when my two older boys were younger. She would walk in and when they were little kids, and she would say, "You're going to be the actor and you're going to be the athlete." And it was cute. It was totally innocent. And
What was your reaction to that?
I was just like, can we not pigeonhole them at 3 years old? I mean, can we give them a little bit of flexibility here?
So, was she right?
Yeah, close. What the a musician and an athlete, not an actor, but close. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she was just being prescient, but I just thought it was funny. The point is, the stories that we tell ourselves about our lives are influenced by the narrative that we feedback that we get from other people as well.
Right.
And so we can get ourselves bogged down by that narrative, and we forget that we can actually change that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
That if we want to change our story, guess what? You can change the story. The ending hasn't been written yet. And that's what Evan learns through the course of the book, that, you know, he may not have made the right choices always. And clearly he hasn't. That doesn't mean that he can't start making the right choices now.
I love the idea that this story is going to remind them that they don't have to be held back that way.
Yeah, that's really the overriding theme. And it's interesting we're talking about people plugging into a book in different ways, you know, and your best friends being characters, you know. Now, of course, I'm going to say it's a brilliant medium, you know, long-form fiction, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
So I'm sure if I were a photographer, I'd say, now the brilliance of photography is...
Well, there's brilliance everywhere, right? So there you go.
But the brilliance of fiction for me is that in order for it to work, the reader has to generate empathy.
Right.
And they've done studies, you know, among college students about empathy levels. Can you imagine figuring out how you measure this? But
sociology, gotta love it.
Exactly, there you go. And readers of fiction are far more empathetic than people who don't read fiction.
Oh, that is interesting.
And so we need to really start with our kids early. Now, we do it young, you know, we when they're kids, and then we kind of let it go. And especially today with so many distractions of television and internet and
computer
video
games,
you know, all these things, we have to remember that in order to read, you have to put something into it.
Right.
In order to get something out of the book, you have to invest time and your attention. But then you have your character doing things. You see a character who has a problem and has to overcome obstacles. And you say, oh, is that how, I wonder what would I do in that position? And you see how other people overcome obstacles and how other people. And so immediately you've created connections already. Your brain is creating all these wonderful connections with all over the world.
And the only reason you care is because of empathy. Really interesting.
Yeah. I just love the conversation that goes on between readers and writers. I get a lot of emails and things from people. And it's really fascinating that how people respond and why they respond and what they're responding to and how different it all is.
Right. Now, if I understand correctly, you have literally answered every email you've ever received.
Yeah. I mean, one time my hard disk crashed and I think I lost a few. But I always answer my email. It may take me a few weeks, but if someone's going to take the time to track down my website and email me to tell me how much they loved my book, then I am going to take the time to reply to them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Sometimes I've like wanted to send an email to an author and I've just like not done it because I'm like, oh, they're too, you know, they get whatever. But that's really awesome.
I love it when I get one, and I get these all the time. Dear Garth, or whoever's answering this email, because I know it's not Garth, because he would never answer his own email. And then it goes on his whole thing, and I like write back and I say, now why on earth would you think I wouldn't answer my email?
Like what about my story gave you that impression?
Then I go, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. They always answer back, I'm so sorry. I just assumed that you would. And I'm like, yeah.
That's sweet. Do you get emails from young people? Because most of what you write, I believe all of it is adult fiction.
See, everything is adult fiction, but here's what happened with The Art of Racing in the Rain, which was
the third book.
Third book. Woo-hoo! It was my third book, but actually the first book that anybody really cared about. It became kind of a big deal. And I was getting emails from, get this, middle school librarians. I got several from middle school librarians saying, we love your book. We think it has great messages for young people, but we can't put it in our library because we have community standards and it's got a lot of bad words in it. And and it's also got an allegation of sexual molestation of a statutory nature. How about that euphemism?
right. And you can't put that. I guess in elementary school, that's one of the main beefs, of course, with high school is the people who are not able to actually read about the stuff that is happening in their life and is like they're living it, but no, you can't actually read it.
Right. Now, so what we did for that is we created a young reader edition suited for 5th to 8th graders who live in communities where you're not allowed to say the F word.
That is brilliant.
So I picked up a whole bunch of new readers with that. And then in addition to that, because of the popularity of the character of Enzo the dog.
Mm-hmm.
The book is narrated by a dog. We've done these children's picture books now. The third one is coming out near Halloween. So Enzo Races in the Rain is the first one, kind of the launch. And then we just came out with Enzo and the Christmas Tree Hunt, which takes place at a Christmas tree farm on Issaquah Hobart Road for the locals among us.
Yeah. You know, I think I actually one year... I remember going to Issaquah to get a tree, but I actually went to that spot.
Probably.
And
then the new one is a Halloween, and so it's a very scary Halloween. And then the fourth one, I've turned in the manuscript, and the illustrator is just starting his sketches now. So
yeah.
So Enzo's had this whole big life.
Now the art
of age appropriate.
Yeah, well, the art of Racing in the Rain, I guess, was translated into 35 languages.
Yes, 35.
I believe. How about you go ahead and give a little teaser to the listeners after I remind everybody that. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. And back to the next book.
The Art of Racing in the Rain, yes.
Well, but the Art of Racing in the Rain, specifically, you're going to give the teaser.
Yeah, I'm giving you a teaser.
On this one. Okay, shoot.
It's told from the point of view of a dog whose master is a race car driver. And this dog is convinced he's going to be reincarnated as a person in his next life. So he studies everything around him, all human interactions, and so that he can... when he gets reincarnated, he'll be a good citizen and a good person. And he realizes by watching his master race cars that if you took all the principles that make you successful on the racetrack, balance, anticipation, never being worried about things that have already happened that you can't change, only focused on things that are in front of you that you can change. If you took all those principles from the racetrack and applied them to your life as a person, you would be a very fine person. And that's what he aspires to.
Now, how did you find the race car analogy?
Okay, let me tell you.
Do you own Enzo?
There is no... Enzo is beyond.
Yes. Okay, all right. Well, there's that picture of you with a puppy dog.
Yeah, I have a dog. That's Comet. That picture of me is with Comet, our dog. And I love Comet, but, you know, she's really a sweet dog. She ain't no Enzo. So what happened with this book is that I was... when I was making documentary films, a friend of mine asked me to consult on a film. They were looking; it was made in Mongolia, and they were looking for a U.S. distributor for it. And I took a look at this, and it was called State of Dogs. And it was about the belief among the nomadic people in Mongolia that the next incarnation for their dog will be as a person. And so there are very special burial rituals and certain to release the spirit and so forth.
That would make so much sense, given that they would have lived in such tight communion with their canine partners.
And they really depended on the dogs. Mm-hmm. They're not like little lap dogs. These are working dogs. It was really a lovely film. I didn't get involved for a number of reasons, but it was really stuck with me. And I thought, you know, one day I'm going to do something with that. But I had no idea what. Years went by. We moved to Seattle. 2006, the poet Billy Collins comes to town with Seattle Arts and Lectures. Fantastic series. And he's reading his poems at Benaroya Hall, and I'm in the audience listening, and he's reading one of his poems called The Revenant, which means words from the dead. So it's told from the point of view of a dog who's recently been euthanized. So it's being narrated from doggy heaven. And the first line of the poem is this. I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion. Come back to tell you this simple thing. I never liked you, which is funny, right?
Yes.
Okay, it got a huge laugh. It got a huge laugh at Benaroya Hall, okay? And it goes on. It's a very funny poem. There's a nice twist at the end of it. And when I was listening to this and the reaction to the crowd, I was like, oh, wait a second. That's my book. See, the idea of a dog being reincarnated as a person is a great idea, but it has to be told from the dog's point of view. And the dog has to be... you know, a little chippy. The dog has to be like, I'm smarter than everybody in this room, but no one listens to me because my tongue is too floppy to form words.
Right.
So Enzo, the dog, was born. So this was in the summer of 2006.
Right.
I was doing on tour for How Evan Broke His Head and Other Secrets. I was driving to every local bookstore I could go to do readings for two or three people. And I was going down to Central Oregon to do some readings in Bend. And I took my laptop and I got to the hotel and I said, Doggy, you better be ready. And I started writing. The first sentence of my book came to me. Gestures are all that I have. Sometimes they must be grand in nature. And I was like, whoa, I am onto something. And I wrote furiously, just couldn't. And 4 months later, I had finished the first draft of The Art of Racing in the Rain. It was right before Thanksgiving. My in-laws were coming in from out of town. It was Tuesday before Thanksgiving. They were coming in that night. I was going to the Whole Foods on Roosevelt to pick up my Heidi organic game hen.
Right.
Nothing is too good for my mother-in-law. Okay.
Oh, my.
So.
Well, that's why she loves you, right?
Exactly. I was going to pick up my turkey and my cell phone rang and I looked. It was my agent. And I had just sent him the manuscript a couple weeks before that. And I was really psyched because I knew he was going to tell me how brilliant I was and I would be able to relay that to my mother-in-law. So I picked up the phone and I said, what'd you think? And my agent said, it's narrated by a dog.
And you're like, really?
Exactly. I sent it to you. I said, what'd you think of the book? And he said, no one's going to read a book narrated by a dog. No publisher will publish a book narrated by a dog. No marketing department would know how to market a book narrated by a dog. It's not even narrated by a dog. It's narrated by an author pretending to be a dog. To which I said, Victor Hugo wasn't a hunchback. That didn't stop him. He didn't get the joke, apparently. Anyway.
And the woman who wrote Frankenstein was not a dismembered and reassembled
there you go
ugly
see
man. Right.
Meaning that we're allowed sometimes to write outside of our experiences. He didn't get the joke or whatever. He was really mad. He gave me this long lecture about the state of the industry, how it was destroying my career and worse, taking him down with me.
Now that was you said 2006.
This was in 2006,
which was during the beginning of the implosion of the publishing industry.
Yes, exactly.
I would imagine, he was probably actually judging the reality of the publishing world appropriately.
But he
misjudged.
He didn't have a whole lot of imagination, though, because he said, he ended his diatribe by saying, just do me a favor, take this book and throw it away and go write me something I can sell.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
These two words popped into my head and I just had to say them. Not those words.
No, I know.
Words I can say on the radio. I said,
you're
fired. So I fired my agent. And
of course, for all the writers out there, typically you go somewhere to get some advice and they're going to be like, they'll say, if you write it and you love it and your agent doesn't, you should take the agent's advice. You should trust the agent. You should, don't say you're fired to the agent because probably they're in the right and you're in the wrong. And you are the blistering example that the opposite can be true.
It is taking a risk, however, because it was my third novel and to not have an agent was a little tricky. So I started sending it out right away. Agent after agent looked at it, emailed me or called me up and said, like the story, like the idea, like the writing. It's narrated by a dog. We don't know how to sell this book.
Right.
No one would take the book. The following spring, I was at a fundraiser for King County Library Systems, a great library system in the Northwest.
Oh, tell me about it. Oh my gosh.
They do a fantastic gala every spring called Literary Lions. And I go to it whenever I'm in town. I just was at it last year, in fact. And so I went this year in 2007. And I was at the pre-author dinner sitting with a bunch of other writers eating our dinner before we had to go entertain the people.
Right.
And we were going around the table introducing each other and it came to me. And I said, hi, my name is Garth. And I'm really frustrated because I've got this book and I think it's really good, but it's narrated by a dog and no agent will touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And this other writer sitting across the table from me looked up from his plate and he said, oh, hey, you should talk to my agent. He sold my book and it's narrated by a crow.
Ooh, perfect.
He said, I don't see why he couldn't sell a book narrated by a dog.
That's right.
And so it's a true story. Lane Mayhew is his name, a local writer. And I got his agent's information and I sent him my pages. And that agent called me up 2 days later and he was crying. And he said, I love this dog and I love this book. You have to let me have it. And then it went on to do its kind of blockbuster business. I tell that story that I just told you, to high school students and stuff. I'll go speak in schools and things. And I think it's important, for them. The takeaway for that is like you're saying, if you believe something really, truly, deeply, you can't take someone else's word at face value. Because like when I speak to writers, even, someone says, well, what with your editor, what if you have a difference of opinion about something with your editor? if you really believe in it, you can't change it.
Mm-hmm.
Your editor's name isn't going on the book. Yours mm-hmm. is. You get full response. You're going to take all the blame. No, mm-hmm. you're going to get all the accolades if it succeeds. But, you know, you don't get to outsource responsibility.
Right.
And it's the same thing with, you know, I could easily have put the book in a drawer and said, oh, well, didn't work that time. And then that would have been the end of it. But I really believed that it was going to resonate with people.
And it did.
Yeah, and it did. 3.5 years on the New York Times bestseller list. But with kids, you know, with teenagers especially, there's so much going on. They have so many decisions to make about things and going to school, not going to school, taking some time off, going into the military, going into the workforce.
Peace Corps.
All sorts of options. And I know for a fact, because I have a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old, everybody knows what's best for right. that kid. Everybody. The parents know, the friends know, mm-hmm. the teachers know, mm-hmm. the counselors. Everybody knows. Uncle Bob knows, but the only person who has to live with the results are the kid. Uncle Bob already screwed up his life. He doesn't get to screw up anybody else's. You better make decisions that are true to you, that resonate to you, or else you're going to regret where you end up.
And you can't blame anyone else about it.
You can't. I mean, you're living. You're driving the car. So, yeah. you know, you do have to take responsibility for, you know, you have to live deliberately and thoughtfully. And say, I understand what I'm getting into, and I can always get out of it. It's okay. Life seems like it's really short when you're a teenager, but it's actually fairly long.
And you've got roughly about 80 years to explore this planet. Life is an adventure, you know?
Yeah, well, this goes back to being, you know, being sort of guided by the fear of the unknown rather than, you know, the joy or the energy of embracing the unknown.
Discovery. Yeah.
Yeah, but it can be challenging. I mean, certainly it can. And, yeah. You know, but I think it's good. It's a good muscle to train, as is our mm-hmm. empathetic muscle. You know, it's good to, but, you know, even if you're uncomfortable with, you know, foreign languages or something, you don't care for that. There's still many different things you can explore close to home, you know, but having the attitude of being open to new experiences.
Yeah.
You have to imagine all the time that George Clooney from Up in the Air is mm-hmm. laying you off and saying, don't think of this as being laid off. It's a new opportunity for you to open that pizza restaurant.
That's actually a really good movie.
You got to get George Clooney in there at least once in an interview.
Right. Okay, so seriously, it's Up in the Air, right? Yeah, everyone, next time you want to watch a movie, Up in the Air, George Clooney. And then, well, what's the name of the woman? The woman, she's doing really good.
Yeah, she's great. I don't remember her name.
Oh, she's the singer in those movies about girls that sing a bunch. Everyone knows her. It's like it's Poppy. Okay, all right. Anyways, long story short, Up in the Air, check it out. And then you can find that quote moment about open the pizza restaurant you've always wanted to open.
It's, you know, it was fun when I was writing The Art of Racing in the Rain. What was fun is I have a character who's a dog who basically is self-educated, right? Because mm-hmm. no one's going to take a dog to school.
Right.
He tried to teach himself to read, but that just didn't, it was his concentration. He hated the dinosaur, the purple dinosaur. And so he gave up on reading. You know, he says he knows the difference between push and pull on a door, but that's pretty much the extent. Other than that, he's really raised himself by watching television. He spends a lot of time watching television.
Sure.
And if you spent all your time locked in a house watching television, different channels, his Denny, his master, leaves different channels on when he goes to work, because he wants Enzo to have a well-rounded education. So
Aww.
Sometimes the Discovery Channel, sometimes, you know, the
yeah.
Weather Channel. Usually racing channels, though, that's the best.
Right.
You can imagine how distorted your worldview would be. And mm-hmm. so Enzo has a little bit of this in it. You know, he's convinced that humans have evolved from dogs, not from monkeys, and that dogs should have gotten the thumbs and the monkeys, you know. It goes, there's a very, he has a whole convoluted thing. You're like,
that's totally, TV-based worldview.
That totally doesn't make sense. But
he's
passionate about it. But at one point, he's spending the night at his in-laws, Danny's in-laws, and Enzo dubs them the evil twins. He really hates the in-laws. And at some point, they take him and they put him in the attached garage, and they lock him in the garage for the night. And he's like, it's like torture. You know, there's only light from a little teeny clock, and it's just like he's going mad. So he tries to remember all of his favorite movies. And all the movies have racing in them because, of course, he's a race car dog.
Right.
But, you know, Paul Newman is his favorite actor because of his racing movies, as well as the fact that he uses, you know, palm oil from renewable sources instead of from Borneo or something. And of course, he says his third favorite actor is George Clooney because of the fabulous work he did saving children on ER, and also because he looks a little like Enzo around the eyes.
Making ER a believable story.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So that's The Art of Racing in the Rain. And then the most recent one, which came out a little while ago and is local.
Yes.
Yes. A Sudden Light.
A Sudden Light.
So go ahead and do the teaser.
Okay. We got a lot to cover here. Yeah. So I just keep in mind that with my new book, With a Sudden Light, I'm doing a big book club push. So if March, have it picked for your book group, or if anybody out there in your fandom listeners are doing their, want to choose A Sudden Light for their book club, contact me through my website. I have a book club kit. We still have some left, I believe, that we send out that have like a little recipe book and a CD, some music that goes along with the book.
Oh, that's brilliant.
As well as some other stuff. And I, if you would like, I will arrange to Skype with your group. So
I love Skype.
I do a lot of Skype. In fact, I have one tonight. I have three tomorrow. I'm doing a ton of these Skypes.
And that's global. So my friends
that can go
in
anywhere.
Greece, they can be
absolutely
chatting with you about it. Okay. Well, then in that case, don't do too many spoilers.
Oh, I won't do any spoilers.
But I mean, you'd be chatting with these people too, so.
But they will have read the book, and it's fun to talk about the book after you've read it, because there's a lot of stuff in there that we can talk about.
So what's it about, basically?
It's a multi-generational family saga set against the Northwest timber industry. That's sort of like the surface level of what it is. More than that, it's about, again, fathers and sons and how that primary relationship ripples through generations of a family. Mm-hmm. It's about our connection with nature, especially here in the Northwest. If you're going to write about the Northwest, you have to write about trees.
Of course.
And most importantly for me, it's about being open to seeing the unseen, to peeling back the layers, to trying to see the connections that aren't obvious. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it delves into the spiritual world. There's a ghost in it. It is a ghost story, not a scary ghost. It's not The Haunting of Hill House. It is a spiritual ghost story. But there is definitely a ghost wandering the halls of Riddell House in this place called the North Estate. And that's where the Seattle history comes in. Mm-hmm. The North Estate is based on a real place, the Highlands, which is in North Seattle. It's a very wealthy enclave, very high end. It was started around the turn of the 20th century. And it was started by the richest of the rich in Seattle. They wanted a golf course. And so they went and built a golf course. That's the Seattle Country Club. And then they said, well, we should build our little cottages around that. So they drew lots, and the first guy built his house about 10,000 square feet cottage. And the next one, 12,000, and so on. And these are very elaborate, and the whole grounds were designed by the Olmsted brothers, who had also done the master plan for the Seattle parks. So it was very beautiful, very special, and very exclusive. I grew up down the hill from there. I grew up in Innis Arden, which is a development that used to be the hunting grounds of the Boeing family. So then
it was
their private reserve. And then they turned it into housing in the 50s. So that's where I grew up. In the shadow of the Highlands. And so it kind of stuck with me, I guess, always looking up the hill and seeing those mansions up on the hill and wondering who lives there.
But it's not actually locked off like a gated community?
It is a completely gated community. Yeah, okay. So my story is really about, it takes place, it's set mostly in 1990, but it's about five generations of this family. In 1990, there's a young man, Trevor Riddell, the youngest in the line of Riddell family. And his parents are on the verge of divorce. And so his father brings him home.
He's 14.
His father brings him home to Riddell House for the first time. He's never seen this place. His father never talks about his own history, never talks about his family history. There's something of a shame that he grew up in Connecticut, and so he doesn't know. Trevor doesn't know. He's clean when he walks in. He walks into this house. It's this old mansion. It's practically collapsing. It's really unkempt. It's falling apart. But at one point, it was clearly very wealthy and very special. He comes in. He meets for the first time his crazy aunt, Serena.
Sister Serena. Yeah.
When Trevor's father said, "You're going to meet your aunt," he figured, like dowdy old Mrs. Doubtfire aunt sort of thing. No, Serena is 35 years old and she's smoking hot, and she is messing with Trevor's brain in a big way. Everything's a game with her. She's flirting with him. She's, you can imagine how this can mess with the kid, for the mind of a 14-year-old. And then he meets his grandfather, Grandpa Samuel.
What I found interesting about A Sudden Light was it, like, I just couldn't land somewhere that I didn't want to stay. So I'm assuming the entire book is that juicy.
Well, there's a lot of juice in there. And Serena is was a hilarious character to write. I loved writing Serena. And, you know, there are spoilers that I'm not going to give, obviously.
Did I spoil?
No.
Okay.
Because that's what it's dealing with. It's dealing with, you know, the ramifications of actions that we've taken and how they stay with us. How we can pretend to leave things behind, but we don't leave them behind. And not just intra-generationally, but intergenerationally. That a discussion had between a father and son in 1890 about their holdings in the timber industry and their conservation is the same story that's had between a different father and a son in the same family in 1990.
Right.
That we carry these things forward in every way. And there's a lot of fun stuff in there about Northwest history, about the history of the topography and about trees. There's tree climbing in there. In fact, two of the guys back in the 1890s for fun, for sport, climb, though they're cutting down trees, they're harvesting them.
Right.
They also free climb trees. And
wow.
So I did some tree climbing, not free climbing. I did it roped in. I did it with ropes. There's a great climbing guide guru down in Portland. Tim Kovar is his name. He has a place called Tree Climbing Planet. And he takes people up into trees. He took me up into an 800-year-old redwood, a couple hundred feet in the air. And it's just, you know, your relationship changes with a tree. But so it has all these different things in it, the book does. And Serena's a great character. There's Brother Jones and his issues. Mm-hmm. There's Grandpa Samuel, Grandpa Samuel may or may not have dementia. It's not clear. But immediately forms a bond with young Trevor, and then Trevor starts wandering this house. In 1990, there were no Xboxes, there was no cable TV.
Yep,
and
that was the year I graduated.
He's left to his own devices, you know, and so he would, in those days, we explored things, right?
I love that you took the liberty as the writer, and thank you. I know why you did it too, because you explained a little bit more at the coffee shop, but taking it back to 1990 and allowing us to more fully experience that story without the interruptions of the modern technological age.
Yeah, there's a certain innocence, I think, about.
Thanks.
See, he's open to seeing things. He is innocent. He's coming into this family without all the baggage. He doesn't know the family story, and so he doesn't have the judgment that comes with that. The narrative is beginning.
Right.
And so he gets to this house and he meets these people for the first time. And then he starts to listen to the house. He realizes it makes noise. It talks. Mm-hmm. It sighs. It groans. And he listens closer and he realizes, wait, there's something talking to him. And as he starts exploring and opening doors that haven't been opened in decades and finding little weird secret passages in these old houses, they would have these back stairs and front stairs and things like this.
Right.
He discovers some journals written by one of his ancestors. He finds letters between some of them. And he starts to put together a story of what happened back in around the turn of the...
It's a fresh viewpoint. It's not one that carries an inherited narrative.
Right. And so as the more he gets into it, the more he believes, the more he starts to understand, the more the spirit of the house begins to reveal itself to him until there ultimately is an encounter with the spirit in order to set the family legacy
free.
Yeah. His mission is to get everybody... Good. We need to get ourselves on track as an entire family, generations of a family. And so it's about all these sorts of things. And it's, you know, I think it's pretty good.
Well, I mean, The Art of Racing the Rain is absolutely sweet, endearing, and fabulous. And the other two I haven't touched upon, you know, but they sound great.
I hope you enjoy it.
I imagine I will.
And then you'll call me up and say, now, what is it about your father visiting you in his dreams after he died? And then we'll have to have that discussion.
Yeah, let's save it. Let's save it for the end. Thanks for coming by, Garth.
It's my pleasure. Wake up, Maggie.
hard anymore. You led me away from home just to save you from being alone. You stole my soul, and that's a pain I can do without. All I needed was a friend to lend a guiding hand, but you turned into a lover and mother. What a lover, you wore me out. All you did was wreck my bed, and in the morning kicked me in the head. Oh, Maggie, I couldn't have tried anymore. You led me away from home, 'cause you didn't wanna be alone. You stole my heart, I couldn't leave you if I tried. Rock and roll.